Okay, we are on page 104. And we're at Pasuk Chaf 20, at the very end of the parsha there. Was after these things. It was told to Avram, saying, Milcah has also given birth to your brother Nachar. She has given birth to children. So if we look in Rashi here, the second column, three lines down, after these things, and it was told. So Rashi says, "Beshuvu mehar Maria." When Avram was returning from the Akedah from Har Maria, "Haya Avram maharher vaomer." He was singing to himself, and he said, "Ilo haya benai shachut. If my son had been shechted, kavar haya holech below banim. He would have gone away without having had children. Haya lila sio isha mibnos enar eshko umamre." You know what? I have to marry him off. There's nobody in my family really who is appropriate for him, meaning the extended family. I'll have to marry him off to, good girls, but ones that we would have preferred not to, from the neighboring non-Jewish countries. So at that point, Bisro HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem informed him, Shenolda Rivka Basugo. No need. Rivka has been born. Hashem informed him that Yitzchak's wife had been born. Vezoa Deram Ha'ela. And that's what it means, after these things, here Huri Devarim, meaning the thoughts that Avram was having, Shahayu Aide Akedah, which were spurred by the Akedah taking place. The Aruch Chaim, who was he's one of the later Mefarshim on Chumash, and often gives mystical explanations for what's happening in Chumash. So on this pasuk, he says that the timing is obviously intentional and very deliberate, that Yitzchak, before the Akedah, was still functioning from, in the Kabbalistic terms, but from the feminine side, meaning God expresses himself in both masculine and feminine terms. There's most of the places we find in Chumash where it speaks about God, it's from a masculine perspective, but in many places we also hear about the Shekhinah, the divine presence, which is God's feminine expression. Within man himself, there's also a conception of a masculine and a feminine. And Yitzchak, until that point, had not achieved the masculine element of his personality. He had to go through the Akedah before that could come to the fore. He had been passive in a certain way before the Akedah, and having the Akedah having transpired, Yitzchak making that choice and going through with it, it changed his personality in a fundamental way that now he can embrace his masculine element as well. Now that Yitzchak was, so to speak, a man, now he could get married to a woman. And at that point, that's when the birth of Rivka was announced to him. When Yitzchak became a man, it became relevant that he could have a wife as well. Oftentimes, you just have to move forward without understanding why things are the way they are. History, Hashem reveals things in their proper time, and you have to take that leap of faith, as it were, in order to move forward, even though you don't understand if I do X or I do Y, what's going to be. Don't worry about what's going to be. Just take the step that you're supposed to take and allow history to play out in the way that it's supposed to play out. Rav Shach Zatzal, when he was in Europe, and as the yeshivas in Europe were getting crushed, meaning obviously the Germans on one side, but the Russians were invading from the other side, and the Russians were no friends to the yeshivas either. Whatever town the Russians came into, they used to take over, and they would basically outlaw religious observance, and certainly yeshivas. So Rav Shach, all the little yeshivas had fled to Vilna at one point, where Reb Chaim Moser Grzhensky was the Rav, and he offered them safe haven there, which was in Lithuania. But then the Russians took over Vilna. So now everybody was faced with a choice. Where do you go from here? That was supposed to be like the safe zone. So Rav Shach had two choices. He could either go, as a young Rosh Yeshiva, like in his 30s, he could either go to Eretz Yisrael, which he thought was the right choice, be far away from the war, obviously a place to open yeshiva, etc. Or he could go to Klesk, where Rav Aaron Cutler Zatzal had his yeshiva initially, and there was a teaching position waiting there for Rav Shach. And not only that, his wife was in Klesk. She had family there, and she was a practicing pharmacist. She had parnasa there as well. And not only that, but if he applied for Eretz Yisrael, to emigrate to Eretz Yisrael, the Russians might view the application itself as, you know, a vote against them, and perhaps punish him just for applying to leave. So he had no idea what to do. He really wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, but there were all these other factors on the other side. And he was lost in his thoughts. So what he didn't decide. He wrote, he had to let his wife know what was going to happen. So he wrote two letters, right? Letter A and letter B, both in stamped envelopes. And one said, we're going to Israel. Mm-hmm. And one said, I'm coming to you in Klesk. And he was standing in line at the post office, obviously during wartime. It was long lines and everybody's very tense and nervous and agitated. So fine, and as he's thinking in the line, what should he do? He still couldn't, there was no way to decide. You have no idea which way is going to hurt you in the end. So finally, it's his, you know, person, as you're waiting at the post office, you know how frustrating it can be. And finally, it's his turn. He's standing in front of the clerk, and he's there lost in thought. And they're not having any of that. The clerk grabbed an envelope from his hand and said, next. He said, what are you doing? I didn't give that to you. She said, next. And it was the letter.
She
made the decision. It was the letter that said they were going to Eretz Yisrael. So that's what decided it for him. And ultimately, that's what saved him in the end. If we continue on in the Pesukim and Chaf Aleph, now the psukim are going to detail the generations of Nachar. As Utz Bechuro, Milcah gave birth to Utz, his oldest son, Ves Buz Achiv, and to Buz, his brother, Ves Kmua Avi Aram, and Kmua, who eventually became the father of the nation of Aram, Ves Kesed, Ves Chazo, Ves Pildash, Ves Yidlov, all these brothers, Ves Besuel. Besuel was the father of Rivka. Uvesuel yalad es Rivka. He gave birth to Rivka. Shmona Ela yalda Milcah lenachar. So these were the eight sons that Milcah delivered to Nachar. Achi Avraham, the brother of Avraham. Ufilaksho shmaru uma v'teled gam hi es Tavach. And in addition to his wife Milcah, he had a concubine called Reuma, and she also gave birth to a child whose name was Tavach, and another one was Kacham, was Tachash, Vesmacha, for a total of 12. If we look in Rashi, the last line of Rashi on the page, Uvesul yalad es Rivka, Besul gave birth to Rivka, kol yichasin halala lo nichtu ela bishvil pasik zeh. All of this whole genealogy is irrelevant. The only reason we're being told is to get to the point of Rivka. That's what's important for us. We want to know what's happening until we get to Rivka, and then we can move on. The Rashi has comments quoting Chazal, obviously, like this in many different places, where we find genealogies that seem abruptly to stop at a certain point. And Rashi says, because it's that point, that was the whole point, meaning all the previous generations sort of didn't matter, meaning we needed to get to the tzaddik that we're talking about, be it Moshe, be it Rivka, be it whoever it is, and everything was culminating in that goal. the Rambam writes that in the Parish Mishnayos, in Shmona Prakim, that hashkafically, everything in this world is done for the sake of man, meaning we obviously are the point of the world. Hashem's setting it up as a chesed for us, and so that we can do the avodah that we're supposed to do, which means that it's not like we share equal space with the gorillas and the buildings and the construction and the other nations and everything else that's in the world. No, the point is man, and man in his ultimate state. It's both, everything is coming to serve man. And not only man, but the tzaddik as well. So he gives, just as a rough example, if you find a huge, like a Taj Mahal built in India, So what does that have to do with the Jews? How does that help man serve God? Where's the purpose in that? He said, most probably at some point, some guy is going to be, some Talmud Chacham, some righteous person, is going to be walking past that building in India, right? Today, likely it would be somebody from Chabad, right?
Everywhere.
And they're going to be hot, and they're going to sit for a few minutes in the shade and cool down and be able to get on with the work that they're supposed to be doing. And that's the whole reason why that building was built was for that one moment to facilitate some person's avoda in his service to God. When we have this conception in mind, everything is about the tzaddik. Everything is about the person who has maximized themselves and optimized themselves and fulfilled their potential to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Which, where does that leave the rest of us? So it doesn't, when we say somebody has optimized their potential, it doesn't necessarily mean they're famous for it. The Tanakh and the Gemara and the Midrashim and throughout the ages have been a proliferation of people who have been detailed, who after the fact, we know they were very great, but they weren't famous at the time. Fame is not a factor here, or acknowledgement is not a factor here. A person could be very great, they could be doing everything they're supposed to, and the world is built for them, as it were. Most of us, though, we tend to kick back at that because then we'll feel bad. Like, if I'm not that person, then what's my role here? So that this is really a fundamental idea. Everybody has the choice to be that person. Our Yetzirah is able to kick at us and say, you're never going to be that person. You're not going to be the tzaddik, you know, Yesod Olam, the fundamental constant of the world that Hashem built the world for. So because of that, you don't have to do X, Y, or Z. That's not true. Every person has the potential to be that tzaddik. Where you fit into the Bria, you could either be the tzaddik, or you could be serving the tzaddik, or you could be, you know, doing your own thing. And incidentally, something you do will eventually serve that tzaddik who's serving Hashem as well. But that's your choice, where you fit into the grand scheme of things. We shouldn't fool ourselves to say, I'm not that person, and therefore, what can I do? It's not a big deal if I spend my days playing games, watching TV, whatever it is, because I'm never going to be that person anyway. You choose where you click in to Hashem's grand plan. If you want to be the ultimate, like the apex, the zenith, the apogee of Hashem's design, then that's your choice. You can do that. You just do everything correctly, and you will ipso facto be that person. And if you choose to let your Yetzirah say, no, it's okay, relax, you could be that person as well. But that choice is up to yours. Hashem decides everything. The Gemara says the one thing he doesn't decide is your moral choices. You decide who you're going to be, and each and every one of us, without acknowledgement, can be the tzaddik yisod olam, which the whole rest of the world is coming to serve. When a person's able to achieve these levels, you can sometimes see it, because the reactions to people are different, because they know what they're supposed to be doing. They've worked on themselves, and they have a much clearer perception of how to respond in difficult situations. Obviously, most of us are human, and when people bother us, we get annoyed. And at some point, no matter how good we are at smiling at people, that smile cracks. This is true for Gedolim as well. And if you think, you know, the nunuks of the community bother you, you can't believe when a prominent rabbi is in town or in their community, how much they bother them as well. It's like exponentially more. We speak about many great rabbis here. So in Eretz Yisrael, we speak about like Rav Yisr Zalman Meltzer, the Brisker Rav, and the Chazon Ish. When those rabbis, who were the greatest of the generation, when they had a question, who did they seek out to talk with? Like, who's the rabbi's rabbi? So that's somebody who's not as well known in the public at large, but he was the Tribuna Rav. When the great rabbis of that generation had somebody they want to confide in or talk out an issue with, they turned to the Tribuna Rav, Rav Dov Berish Wiedenfeld, Zatzal. And a massive genius, but also an immense tzaddik as well. just not as famous as the names you know. But that was who they turned to. And his interaction with the common man was also, it was something that even his own students, it was hard for them to fathom. There was one person who used to come, and you find these people in congregations, they want to tell the rabbi all their ideas on the Parsha. And it could be like an hour. and at Kiddush, and you're smiling at them, and you're like subtly looking at your watch, trying to, like, it goes on and on and on. And it's true for every point they make. And then it becomes like irrelevant stories about their, you know, things that happened to them at work. There was people, we're talking about the Gedolei Ador now, people like that in Rav Dov Wiedenfeld's community who did that to him. And he would smile with the utmost patience, have a pleasant conversation with them. And his Talmidim were going, his students were going out of their minds when they saw it. And when the person finally left, they asked him, what are you, like, why are you wasting your time? You could be learning, and here you're just sitting and smiling at him. He said, you're right, this was not the learning time, this was the chesed time. I was doing chesed. That was what my job at that moment was to let him be heard, to listen to him. Another time, here in St. Louis, we don't get as much, but in more bigger Jewish communities, you have tons, even here we have mishalachim, but not quite the bus station of Mishalachim that you have in other communities, just constant, multiple charity collectors every day coming through shuls and yeshivas and go making their rounds. So in his community, they were coming through as well. One of them, they figured out immediately after he left, stole somebody's tefillin from the yeshiva. So they were incensed. And the Tribune Rav said, no, here's what you have to do. He hasn't left the town yet. I'm giving you money. And take the money to him and say, when you find him, you have to say exactly like this. You're not allowed to add or subtract from what I'm going to tell you. When you find him, say, I think you by accident took the wrong pair of tefillin. Obviously, it was a mistake. We'd like to have them back. But clearly, it looks like you might be able to use some money to buy yourself a new pair of tefillin. Here's the money to do so. And the students fulfilled his command, but the one telling over the story said he was burdened. it was so hard for him to be civil, because this guy came and stole tefillin from the yeshiva guys. But he did what the Rebbe said, and because that was the right thing to do. So when you have this different outlook on life, where you fit in into the Bria, your whole perception, the way you interact with the creation at large, becomes radically different. If we turn the page, beginning the new Parsha, Vayiyu chaye sara mea shana, ve'esrim shana ve'sheva shanam, shnei chaye sara. The years of Sarah were 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. Those were the years of Sarah. So obviously now we're recounting her life. In one more pasuk, Vatama Sarah b'Kiryas Arba. She died in the town of Kiryas Arba. Hi Chevron, which is also known as Chevron, Beretz Kenan. Vayavo Avram Nisbo l'Sarah l'Fkosa. And Avram came to eulogize her and to cry over her. If we look in the first Rashi here. Before we get to the first Rashi, the Medrash on this pasuk quotes a verse from Kohelis, which says, "Vazarach Hashemesh Ba'a Shemesh." The sun shines and the sun sets. And then the Medrash comments on that. Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana. He says, "Do we not know that the sun shines and the sun sets?" I was actually learning with somebody this week who doesn't have an extensive background in Gemara and the works of Chazal. And the Gemara will use these rhetorical questions all the time. And somebody who's used to it, who grew up with the Gemara and with the Medrashim and everything else, we're not even cognizant of it anymore. But he was a little bit taken aback that the Gemara, that the words of Chazal were so sarcastic that they would ask these pointed rhetorical questions, like, why is the verse telling us that? Of course we know that. Like, what's the point of that verse? That underlies a fundamental idea of learning Torah, which we can all embrace, that when you learn Torah, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that you should your house should be a beis vav lechachamim. Your house should be open up to the chachamim, to the wise people, that they should come, because if you allow the scholars into your home, they will rub off on you. And you should wallow in the dust of their feet. So what is that? The word misavik is if you look in your siddurim where it translates Pirkei Avos, they'll often just give a lazy translation of sitting. There's no connotation of sitting in the language of misavik. Sit in the dust of their feet. It's just not what it means. It's actually a very unique word. And we find it by Yaakov, that when Yaakov wrestled with the angel, it says Vayevak, that he wrestled with the angel. So Reb Chaim Voloshin, in his commentary on Pirkei Avos, says, what does it mean, heavy misafik ba'avar rekelehem? You should, let's say, wallow in the dust of their feet. It means actually wrestle in the dust of their feet. So what does that mean? He says, when you have scholars and you're learning from them, you have an obligation to not just accept what they're saying. If you have questions, you have to ask them. We have a precept, Eina Baishal Lomed. If somebody's embarrassed to ask, then they're never going to learn. You have to wrestle with those people in order that you should be satisfied in your head as to what the answers are. Because otherwise, what are you doing? You're just listening. You'll never get anything unless you work it through in your own head as well, which requires you to spar with them intellectually and conceptually to find out what's truly being said until you have a handle on it. And it could be, very rare, but could be they're wrong as well. It could be your question will point to a fallacy in the argument, which they'll acknowledge, and then you'll come to the greater truth. But it has to be a war. And in many places in Tanakh, in the Gemara, we talk about when people are learning as if they're warring with each other. But he says there's one important principle, that it's habi misabe. You have to go to war with the Torah, with your teachers, in order to get to the truth, but it has to be from a perspective, ba'afar raglehem, the dust of their feet. Meaning you have to remember who you are as well. This is a person who's like 20 levels higher than you. He most probably like could put you in his back pocket and knew the question you were going to ask before he asked it. So of course you have to ask it, but you know, pay him the respect that this, or she, the respect that this teacher deserves. They know much, much, much more than you do. So keep that in mind while you're arguing. Most people falter in one of those two things. It used to be that people had a lot of respect for teachers and for people in authority, and they would falter in the first one. They would falter in the heavy misavik. They wouldn't go to war with their teachers when they had a question. They would just tacitly, you know, okay, the Rebbe said, what are you supposed to do? I remember when I was in Reb Tendler's shir, sometimes people would come up to me and they would say, could you ask the Rebbe the question? I'm like, why do I need to ask him? I'm not gonna ask him. Like they were totally flustered. They didn't have the temerity to look like they were even asking a question of the Rebbe. And these were not like very pious people per se. They were regular people. It's just you have an imposing authority figure. It's very hard to push back. Today, unfortunately, the pendulum has swung the other way. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody has a right to an opinion. And your opinion is not, the Rebbe's opinion is not any more valid than my opinion. So I'm going to write my blog and besmirch everybody. And I can become an authority as well. So that's obviously incorrect too. That's disregarding the afar reglayim, that you're sitting in the dust of their feet. The only truth for an individual to truly grow, he has to embrace both concepts as once, both an idea of pushing back, but respecting the person for who they are. So the point being, the Gemara often have these very rhetorical, almost rude kind of formulations when discussing psukim, but only because that's the Derech HaTorah. You have to push back in order to get to the truth. So say this pasuk is like glaringly obvious. What, Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest man's telling me the sun comes up and down? What's going on with that? So the Gemara says, Rav Abba Bar Kahana said that the answer to this is that, no, obviously it's an allegory. It's not telling you about the sun coming up and down. But that it says that the sun shines and the sun sets, it's referring to leaders of the generation, to great people. that before Hashem causes the death of one leader, he always prepares the next leader to take their place before they die. And that's not just, doesn't necessarily, again, have to be somebody who has a leadership position over others, but if they're occupying that place in the world of being a spiritual giant, even if nobody knows about them, but they're upholding the world with their spiritual greatness, then when it comes time for them to move on, Hashem will always prepare or make sure that there's another individual who can fill that gap to continue that foundation. And then the Medrash says, we find this often throughout Tanakh, that by Moshe, before Moshe died, Hashem made sure that Moshe acknowledged Yehoshua in front of the Jewish people, because Yehoshua was the one who was going to replace the void that Moshe would leave by his dying. When Yeshua died, similarly, before Yeshua died, another one rose to greatness, namely Othniel ben Kenaz. Obviously, not a well-known name, but he was considered the paramount scholar of that generation.
Who was that?
Othniel ben Kenaz.
Never. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
And then you find that by Eli, who was the Kohen Gadol, 100 or so years later, a few hundred years later, when he was going to die, and he was the acknowledged leader of the generation, he didn't die before a very young 2-year-old boy came to the Beis HaMikdash, who was going to be the next leader, and that was Shmuel, the prophet Samuel. Who in the last year of Eli's life came to the Beis HaMikdash and was a student for that short time with Eli, and that was the transitional period. And even in later generations, it said when Rabbi Akiva was going to pass away, the day he passed away, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was born, etc., etc. And then the Medrash says, Rabbi Yochanan said, you don't have to look for history. It's right here in the Chumash. It's our pasuk. It says that Rivka was born, and only then could Sarah die. The place that Sarah was holding, the spiritual giant that Sarah was, Sarimenu, who was going to fill that void? So before Sarah could die, her replacement had to be born. And that replacement was Rivka Imenu. Now let's take a look at Rashi. If we look at the first line in Rashi, Vayiyu Chaye Sarah, So Rashi said, so Sarah was 127. That the formulation here, the way the Chumash spells it out, is a little bit funny. It doesn't say she was 127 years old. It says she was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. It's breaking it down. Why is it breaking it into those distinct groups? So Lomar Lecha, to tell you, Echad Nidrash La'atzmo, that each one of those numbers, meaning your ones column, your tons column, your hundreds column, should be darshan, should be explained by itself. Each one has a unique lesson to give over. So what are the lessons here? Bas kuf kebas chaf lechet. When she was 100, she was like a 20-year-old in regard to sin. Ma bas chaf lo chata, just like a 20-year-old hasn't sinned yet, which we'll explain in a moment, shari ena bas onshin, because she's not susceptible to punishment yet, af baskuf, so too Sarah, even when she was 100 below chet, she was without sin. What does that mean? We know, intuitively, that children are not held responsible for their actions. And even though a child might feel guilty about something, but as adults, we know that, you know, that child made a mistake, but they were a child, and some people carry guilt for things they did when they were little, throughout the rest of their adult lives, and that could be very destructive. The reason why we intuitively know that's not a good way to be is because we know that children can't be held responsible. They're children, after all. They don't have the faculties or the moral development or just the raw intellectual cognizance to always understand what's happening or to respond appropriately, so they're not held responsible. When does a person take on the maturity to start making decisions? So we know that what's the age of maturity by Jews? For a girl, it's 12, and for a boy, it's 13. However, that's by people, meaning when a person reaches that age, we expect them to start behaving more like a mensch, to start, less childlike and more mature. However, in Chazal tell us, from a heavenly perspective, Hashem actually holds off for a few more years, meaning he doesn't look at 13 and 12, he holds by 20 years old, that a person has a pass until they're 20. Now, you don't have to share this with your teenagers, but a person, so to speak, has a pass until they're 20 in terms of punishment, meaning they are held accountable, but they won't be punished for things that are done before 20 years old because, again, there's an emotional maturity which a person doesn't reach until that time. So the Pasuk's teaching us that Sarah, at 100 years old, it was like she was 20, meaning just like every 20-year-old is starting with a fresh board as if they've never sinned because the sin hasn't been allowed to, you know, go on their record. Sarah, at 100 years old, basically a whole life at that point, as if she was 20. She had never done any sin that would have been right, that would have been proper to blacken her record.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So between 13 and 20, or 12 to 20 yeah. for girls, because when the boy has a bar mitzvah, you know, he has a prayer that now, you know, the father's not responsible anymore, right? So who's responsible for the sins, you know, like during the bar mitzvah and the 20? Nobody, or the parents are still...
When you say responsible for what?
Not responsible, but punish, you know, right? I mean...
So if the child does something wrong, let's say a 15-year-old, let's give an extreme example, Chas v'Shalom murders somebody, so then they would have to be killed, meaning they fall under all the human legal system that Hashem has given us, the Sanhedrin, the best in the court system. Once a boy turns 13, he's held fully responsible for his own actions. But in terms of when we speak about a heavenly punishment after 120 years, will a person be punished for his averas or not? That calculation doesn't start until they're 20.
Right. But if they do an avera below 20, because I think the parent is responsible, right? According to Judaism, if they are under 12 or 13, right? It goes to their hezbon, right, or not? That's what I thought.
In a certain way. Meaning, when we really... not quite. We're not punished for all of our children's affairs. That's... we'd have to give a different share on this topic. But no, it's not a one-to-one ratio by any means.
Okay. Yeah. Because I remember when
there's
a bar mitzvah, there's always a prayer, right?
Poter meon shoshal zeh. Yeah, of course. That's the language that the father says, that I'm exempted from the punishment of this one.
Right.
There is a talk. What does that mean exactly? Does it mean that I'm exempted from the punishment of not educating him properly? That's what it might mean. Not actually from his sins, but from the obligations that I have towards him. Now he's his own man. He's responsible for himself, kind of thing. So yeah, there's what to talk about. And Rashi continues, Ubas Chav Kibas Zayin LeYofi. She was a 20-year-old, like a 7-year-old, regarding beauty. So that that conception, what does it mean a 7-year-old is beautiful? Rav Moshe said, obviously we don't think of 7-year-olds as being the epitome of beauty, of Yofi. A 20-year-old, if anything, is more beautiful, obviously, than a 7-year-old. So what does it mean that Sarah was, at 20, was like a 7-year-old for beauty? He said the beauty that a 7-year-old has is that children have a natural charisma, that even if they're mishkababbled in their appearance, like their shoelaces are untied or their faces are smeared with chocolate or whatever it is, so that's cute, right? There's a natural cuteness that accompanies a kid no matter what. If a child's in their messy bed and, they're one sock off, one sock on, when they're 5 years old, 6 years old, a mother will fell over that. Like, she'll want to take a picture of that. And the kid will always be embarrassed about that picture for the rest of their life. But she loves it. How can you not eat that up? That same kid, 10 years later, when they're repeating that pose, right? Messy bed, chocolate on their face, the mother gets very angry at them. They don't have that charisma anymore, that cuteness. So that's what Rav Moshe says the Yofi here is referring to. Sarah, to her, it's hard to say, the innocence of her personality, but she was such a pure soul that there was never that sense of growing out of that natural charisma. Even at 20 years old, she had that chen, that grace in the eyes of others that she could do no wrong. She was able to retain that through her personal spiritual standing. Okay, we'll try one more idea. We're actually in the middle of a host of ideas, but we'll have to finish up next time. But just to explain this this final Rashi a little bit, Rav Yerucham says that the Pasuk in Tehillim in Parak Lamed Zayin, chapter 37, says that Yodei Hashem Yimei Tamimim. Hashem knows the days of those who are tamim. And he said, and the Chazal there darshan that this is referring to Sarah, who all of her days were tamim. They were complete and pure. Rav Yerucham says, when a person does an action, ideally it should be shalim. And that's what, when the Tanakh, when the Chumash refers to somebody as being complete, as being tamim, it means their actions were complete from every possible perspective. And this is a high praise that we're not even cognizant of, that the avos, the imahos in Tanakh, when they did something, every aspect of everything they did was perfect. Meaning, when Avraham served guest, there was no hisrashlus, there was no laziness in any element of that. He told his children quickly, maher, he gave them the best food, he washed their feet personally. Every single element of Avram's bringing in guests, he did it to the utmost. Similarly, we are going to see with Rivka and Mir Sashem that when she does chesed for Eliezer, she goes all out. There's no part of her that she holds back because, okay, I've done enough for him already. No, she says, I'm going to give you water, I'm going to give your animals water, yeah, you can come to us for food. It just keeps going and going and going as if Rivka herself doesn't exist. She's purely a vessel to give chesed to Eliezer when he comes. This conception of being shalim, of being tamim, complete in one's actions, it comes from the Midas Ha'emes, Rabbi Yocham says. When you have a conception of what's true in the world, then, like we explained before, that drives everything you do. So if you know why you're doing it, you're not doing it because you're a naturally nice person. Natural niceness stops at some point. Like, there's only so much you're going to do, but no more. But when you know you're doing it because this is what Hashem wants, then you go all out, and there is no roadblock. You just keep going and going because that's what this act requires at the moment. And it informs your actions of the way they are. Rav Shach, when he was young, he told Dover that as he went to yeshiva very early as a young boy, but when he would go out to eat on Shabbos, at meals, one of the meals he went to, the husband of the family he was eating the meal by Friday night, had invited, you know, a traveling itinerant poor person who was passing through town for a meal as well. And in those days, right on today, we have certain social services. There are food banks and there's food stamps and there's a person can eat if they want to. In those days, a person was poor; they could just be starving. There wasn't these options available. So that was true for Jewish people as well. So this poor person who had been picked up by this Baal Bus, by this father, very nicely, of course, to invite him for a Friday night dinner. He was really hungry. So as the meal started, you know, you sing Shalom Aleichem and say Kiddush, and they serve the fish. And then the Baal Bus, the father, the husband, started singing Zmiros, like the minhag is. And at which point the poor guest said, would it be possible that we could just serve the next course? And the husband was very taken aback. People who like to sing don't like to be interrupted when they're singing. So he said, Lil Dar Hearts, no, we're singing Smiros. So the wife, Rav Shach, heard the wife whisper into her husband's ear, tell me, why did you invite him? Did you invite him to teach him Dar Hearts? Did you invite him to listen to your Smiros? Or did you invite him to serve him a meal? So the husband got the message. But that's what we're talking about. When you know why you do something, when it comes from the MS of the thing that you're doing, the truth of it, you do it in a much different way and informs everything you do. Okay, Mirza Hashem will pick up again at this point.